Welcome back to Question Medicine 2018. I am Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, and this is Questioning Medicine 2018. Like I said, here we go, kicking it off. We're going to do some listener questions, as always. If you have any questions, then email me directly, Andrew Bilt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com, or just reach out on Twitter, at Andrew Bilt. I'll get back to you. We'll talk it up. As always, if you got any comments, concerns, if you want certain articles, or something you want to read, something you're interested in, something you want me to talk about, be more than happy. Because after all, this show is really about you. It's about you, the listener. Because without you, it's just me talking into a microphone. And that would get pretty awkward after a while. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, reservation, and hopefully no more constipation, let's give you some... So without further ado, without any hesitation, reservation, let's go ahead and kick it off. Alright, here we go. Back at it, kicking it off. Questioning Medicine, like I said... I'm going to try to do one a week, and some of these podcasts are going to be 20, 25, maybe even 30 minutes long. And if that's too long for you to listen to, don't worry about it. Don't listen to the whole thing. Just hit pause at 20 minutes. I usually try to keep it at 20 minutes or less, but there's just so many articles building up and questions. And if I'm reading five articles a week and I only podcast about five articles a week, I'll stay behind. So I need to start doing six, seven topics, articles, things until I get caught up. And if you don't like it, that's not for you. That's okay. The price is still going to be $350. You don't pay a thing. And if you don't like more knowledge, that's okay. So here we go. Listener questions, listener feedback. Matt sent one on the Questioning Medicine website, which I need to update. But he sent in a thing. Matt, you know who you are. And it was about coronary CTs. And his comment is that he uses coronary CTs to get people off of statins. Where he works at, it's $99 and it's not covered by insurance. So he says this is less of a cost to the system, and that to him, he gets these new patients that are on statins. And in order to get them off statins, he gets them a coronary CT, because if he can show them a test that shows a calcium score of zero, then they're more likely to believe a test than they are maybe the calculator or ASCVD risk score that he shows them. So maybe he saves money in the long haul. Couple things with this. Saves money in the long haul. Statins are $4 a month, roughly, at Walmart. The Walmart $4 list. In my town, actually, one of the in St. Petersburg here, one of the grocery stores gives away a statin for free. Again, $350, just like this podcast. So it doesn't really get any cheaper than that. $99 is not a lot, absolutely not, but it's more than a lot of my patients want to pay out of pocket. So maybe he, you know, works in an area that has more affluent patient population, which is great. Overall, it's still a cost or a burden on the healthcare system, because you have to remember, when the nurse or the radiology tech or the radiologist reading it, whoever's doing all the things that go into this, when they are putting someone in a coronary CT or doing coronary CTs, they're not doing something else, right? When they are doing a test that is essentially semi-worthless, they're not doing a test that could potentially actually save a life. So there's still a burden on the healthcare system there. I don't know if you can quite get away with that. And that's unfortunate that he has so many of these patients that are already on statins for primary prevention that don't need it. I mean, depending on which guidelines you read, 7.5%, 10% is about the risk cutoff for statins primary prevention. We could debate all day on whether that's the real numbers used in the real trials. Again, that they were much higher risk than that to show benefit. But again, looking at guidelines, we're looking at 7.5%, 10%, depending on where you're at. And that means that if these patients are on statins and don't need them, and he's saying not only do they not need them, but it's not even worth you taking this $4 drug for the next 2 years to make up the cost. That means these are 40-year-olds that are otherwise healthy, not smoking, non-diabetics, non obese individuals that clearly have at least a little bit of money, $99 worth, to get these tests. So he has a great patient population there. I mean, I think we all wish that we had healthy 40-year-olds or 45-year-olds that didn't have any real comorbid conditions. However, that begs the question of what is a healthy 45-year-old doing going to the doctor? I mean, that just doesn't happen. Or healthy 20-year-old or 30-year-old, even 40-year-old. When you're healthy, you don't go to the doctor because you're healthy. You don't need to go to the doctor. I know we'd like to think that we need primary checkups, but realistically, I mean, we've talked about this before in Questioning Medicine. It just came out recently in Primary Care Wrap. The annual screening or annual health checkup does give you more diagnoses. There are more diagnoses in your chart if you have an annual physical. There is not an increase in any outcomes that we really care about. So what to do with that information, I don't know. It's interesting. Matt, thanks for writing in. Thanks for listening. I do oh so appreciate it. Next listener question comes on, I'm going to leave the name out, but it comes on after the whole ACE ARB in the last podcast. And then the question was, what if someone has an allergy to an ACE inhibitor and they have the angioedema, can you still give the ARB? And this is my fault. I wasn't totally clear on this on the last podcast, but the answer is yes. Yes, go ahead and right away. Because remember, the risk of angioedema with an ARB is equal to placebo. So if someone has angioedema with an ACE inhibitor, would you still be willing to give them placebo? And I think, of course, the answer is yes. We'd all be willing to give them placebo. It's placebo. It's a sugar pill. It's a Skittle. They eat it all the time. So would you be willing to give them a sugar pill? And if your answer is yes, then you have to be willing to give them an ARB because the rates of angioedema are the exact same. So that covers that topic. You have an ACE inhibitor, angioedema, don't be afraid. Still write for the ARB. And hopefully, you are now writing for the ARB more often after that podcast. And last but not least, this last one was not a listener question. It was actually my fiance was at work. She had a medical student. Medical students are wonderful, and medical students are not so wonderful. We all know that they're wonderful. We know that they invoke curiosity in the medical literature that we've never seen before, or at least that is invigorating to get you back out there to question medicine. And what do I mean by that? Well, this medical student goes up and he said, or maybe she, I don't really know who, or I don't know their sex, but the question was, Dr. Narducci, although as you can tell, Narducci is Italian, so it probably sounded a little something like this. Dr. Narducci, I have a question for you. Why are some bisphosphonates better for hip fractures and some are better for vertebral fractures? I need to know. Because, you know, the Italian, anyways, they're eating pasta. It was crazy. In clinic. So that's the question. Why are some bisphosphonates better than others when it comes to hip fractures and when it comes to vertebral fractures? And this is what we're taught in medical school, and this is what the boards test on. But I think the real question needs to be is not why are some better than others, but are some better than others? So in order to tell if one drug is better than another drug, you need a trial. You don't need two separate trials where we have different patient populations, we have different inclusion and exclusion criteria. We need trials which two drugs are put in the same trial with the same patient population in the same country, in the same area, at the same time, and then they're studied head to head. That's how you tell. And don't worry, this has been done. This has been done in the Fosamax Actonol comparator trial as the FACT trial. And basically, here's what you need to know. You had oral alendronate, 60 milligrams weekly, versus oral risedronate, 35 milligrams weekly, in just over 1,000 postmenopausal women. That's key, postmenopausal. We don't really have good evidence, and no real good evidence at all, for premenopausal, and we don't have it on men either. So when we're talking about osteoporosis, it's always postmenopausal women. That's key piece of all data when it comes to osteoporosis and these medications that we use to treat osteoporosis. So they followed them up for 12 months, and this was a double-blind study. The primary outcome measure was a change in the hip bone mineral density at 12 months. And the primary outcome, alendronate group had a 1.4% bone mineral density greater increase in the compared with resendronate. I don't know if I'm saying resendronate properly. I don't write for it. But anyways, it was better. Alendronate was better when you were looking at bone mineral density. And that sounds awesome, right? I mean, that sounds like, well, then alendronate must be the right top dog, and that must be the correct answer on all the boards. But not so fast. Because bone mineral density is a surrogate marker for a risk factor. Osteoporosis is a risk factor. Osteoporosis is a risk factor for the big medical problem, which is a hip fracture. Thus, one really isn't necessarily better because it's only better for a surrogate marker of a risk factor. And they followed this same study up at 2 years, and guess what? Alendronate still was the winner. It still looked better, but again, no proven patient-oriented outcomes. They did this same head-to-head trial, again, in a motion study, or the motion study, and this was once monthly ibandronate, 150 milligrams, versus weekly alendronate, 70 milligram. And basically, here's what you need to know again. Increases in the bone mineral density from baseline were similar in both treatment groups, as were the risk for vertebral fractures, about 0.6 in both groups. And you say, well, that's vertebral fractures. What about the things we really care about? The things that really matter, like the non-vertebral fracture, specifically the hip, that's the big one. As recently in a paper chase, about 1 in 10, 1 in 12 are dead at 30. If they're elderly, dead at 30 days with a hip fracture. That's the big deal. Not the incidence of non-vertebral fractures in this study, between the two, right about 1.5% difference for both of them. Statistically speaking, there was no difference. And before we wrap this section up, before we jump into some quick articles, I know everyone's going to say, yeah, but look, the difference with alendronate was that it had greater bone mineral density. So, I mean, greater bone mineral density, I know that it's not the patient-oriented outcome, Andrew, but that's got to be good, right? I mean, that must mean it's better. That must mean it's a better drug, right? Well, maybe you can think that, except for at one time we thought niacin was awesome because it raised the HDL. And now we know, oops, our bad. At one time, we thought sulfonylureas were good because they lowered the A1C. But now pretty much every study that comes out about them, and there's still some more coming, but shows, if anything, there's no benefit and probably an increase in mortality. You got to follow the outcomes, and you can't follow the numbers. So which one's really better? We don't have that data right now. We can't really say. But if they need to be on a bisphosphonate, then they need to be on a bisphosphonate. And probably just pick the one that has the least side effects, is the easiest to use, and is the most affordable for your patient. Whew. Enough with that. Let's get on to some of the medical literature for just a few more minutes. All right, so let's get into the medical literature. What have I been reading? Well, one of the things that caught my eye, I guess, was NPR piece. Oh yes, an NPR piece. And it actually had to do with osteoporosis. So funny, we're just talking about it with when to use bisphosphonates, but with osteoporosis, I guess when it rains, it pours. And one of my favorite quotes from this NPR piece was, "So there in the middle of the hotel room, someone literally stood up, drew a line through a graph depicting diminishing bone density and decreed, every woman on one side of this line has a disease." Osteoporosis, this magical line that we've depicted of a disease, is probably really not a disease. It's not Bible science, if you will. It's just something that we've created to be Bible, with probably very little science behind it. Then there was this recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine, June 7, 2018, that looked at the old school drug with a new school hit, if you will. Whoop whoop. All right, here's an important thing in this next article. The one I'm about to talk about, I say mifepristone, misoprostol, misoprostol, and maybe a whole host of other mispronunciations of the drug. However, what I'm trying to say is the recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine mifepristone pretreatment for medical management of early pregnancy loss. Mifepristone pretreatment for medical management of early pregnancy loss. Basically, it was asking, have you ever had a woman that has a non-viable pregnancy between 5 to 12 weeks of completed gestation? And she wants to have the evacuation of this in the privacy of her own home. And you're thinking, well, misoprostol given vaginally is an option and it is supported in the guidelines, but it has a very low success rate when there's a closed cervical OS, which, let's be honest, most of them are at 5 to 12 weeks. And then, boom, a new trial on an old drug. Mifepristone 24 hours prior to misoprostol use. So misoprostol has a high failure rate in women with closed cervical OS, meaning 15 to 40% of women need another dose or uterine aspiration. So this study looked at 300 women with non-viable intrauterine pregnancy, and then you were randomized to one of two groups, either the pre-treatment group with mifepristone 24 hours prior to misoprostol, or just straight up misoprostol use. The primary outcome was gestational sac expulsion by initial follow-up, and then were there any additional interventions at 30 days? Meaning, did you have to go in and get an evacuation done? When you look at the results for the first initial follow-up, after the patient goes home and they either take their mifepristone, then misoprostol, or just the straight-up misoprostol, the addition of mifepristone, 84% success rate versus just 67% success rate with misoprostol. That's a number needed to treat of 6. And when you looked at how many women needed uterine aspiration at 30 days, again, we're looking at only 9% with the addition of mifepristone versus 24% with misoprostol alone. Again, a round number needed to treat of 6 to 7. These are impressive numbers and probably should be used for most women now that have a non-viable pregnancy at 5 to 12 weeks. Whew, now that we got that out of the way, let's get to some easy drugs to talk about. Let's talk about the things that are easy to pronounce, like empagliflozin. That's a good one for you. And that is exactly where we're going next in this JAMA study, April 17, association between sodium glucose co-transport 2 inhibitors, glucagon-like peptide 1 agonists, and dipeptidase 4 inhibitors with all-cause mortality in patients with type 2 diabetes. A systematic review and meta-analysis. Basically, here is what they're looking at. They're saying, in this huge analysis, are the GLP-1 agonists and the DDP-4 inhibitors and the SGLT2 inhibitors, what's better? What's better for reducing mortality? What's better for reducing cardiovascular events in patients with type 2 diabetes? And this is an important question. I think we all know, or at least I hope we all know, we should go to metformin first. It's the head honcho, if you will. But then after that, what do you do? Where do you go next? And the drug reps would like you to go to the DDP4 inhibitors. But as this meta-analysis so clearly points out, and I quote, so let's get the quote voice out. Use of DDP4 inhibitors was not associated with lower mortality than placebo or no treatment. That's key, because when it doesn't beat placebo, then it's safe to say that it doesn't beat placebo. Think about what I said. If your drug can't beat placebo for the outcomes we care about, like dying, then it probably doesn't beat placebo on really other outcomes that we care about. And granted, it's great that it's no worse. That's wonderful. But it certainly should not be your second line or maybe even your third line drug, because we should probably be giving drugs that change some sort of outcome. Now, those drugs that change outcomes that we care about, specifically empagliflozin and liraglutide, that is, of course, the SGLT2 inhibitors, and the GLP-1 agonist. But some quick take-home points that empagliflozin, liraglutide, that reduces the cardiovascular risk and death in type 2 diabetes, but we don't know that they're synergistic. We don't know that they're additive, if you will. So you give metformin and then pick one of them, because you only need to write for one of them. And they'll reduce the A1C about 1, but again, it's not the A1C we care about. It's the not dying that we care about. You should probably only write for one because they still cost a ton. We're talking $400 to $500 per month. Again, metformin is number one. And then if you want to really dig into it, empagliflozin and liraglutide had very high risk patients in their study. When you look at the inclusion criteria for their study, these patients were Hondas, if you will. They were the hypertensive, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholics. They had ASCVDs greater than 15, up into the 20s. These were not the 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12% that you commonly see in your office. So if you put a low risk subgroup or low risk population and you treat it with this high risk drug, you usually don't get the same benefit. The best way I can describe this to someone who can't understand it is that if you give chemo to a woman that has breast, it probably will not do her any benefit unless she has breast cancer. Same principle here. If you give the drug to someone who's not high risk, it probably won't do them as much good because they're not high risk and they're not going to benefit. Anyways, that's enough of that. Let's move on to the next trial. And the next trial is a trial that shows us that the drug you take is only as good as the drug that you take, meaning it's only as good as the drug that you're willing to actually go to the pharmacy and buy and put in your mouth. And I'm, of course, talking about a paper in JAMA Internal Medicine, May 21st, 2018, Trends in Platelet Adenosine Diphosphate P2Y12 Receptor Inhibitor Use and Adherence Among Antiplatelet-Naive Patients After PCI Intervention from 2008 to 2016. And here's what they did. They basically looked at a huge population, patients that got PCI. They then looked to see, did you fill your P2Y12 inhibitor? Did you... And the primary outcome was the number of patients that were identified by pharmacy claims as having actually filled the prescription. And when they looked at it from 2008 to 2016, the number of people who didn't fill a script at all went from 6% to basically 19%. That is a triple-fold increase in the number of non-filled prescriptions for P2Y12 inhibitor. And remember, these people just got PCI. These are not people that were like, oh, it's okay if you want your antiplatelets or not. No, they need to have their antiplatelets on board. And it's interesting, as the number of Plavix prescriptions or filling prescriptions went down, and the number of ticagrelor or prasugrel prescriptions went up, as did the number of non-filled prescriptions. And we could hunt around for the reason for a lot of these non-filled prescriptions, but the authors point out that it might have to do with costs. I mean, we're talking ticagrelor and prasugrel are around $550, and clopidogrel is around $250 for a 12-month supply. And again, I'm sure in certain areas and certain pharmacies, it's even more than that. Really, in the end, it comes down to the best medication is the medication you're willing to take. This next trial falls under the age-old additive of don't do something, just stand there. It is the Vertos tomato IV trial. This looked at vertebroplasty for painful acute osteoporotic vertebral compression fractures. Seriously, with osteoporosis, when it rains, it pours. There was 180 people age 50 or older with 1 to 3 vertebral compression fractures. The mean age was 76. Again, postmenopause. That's really what we're talking about here. 76% were female. The median was 39 days of back pain, and the primary outcome was the self-reported pain on a visual analog scale, meaning you looked at a 1 to 10 scale, what's your pain, you rate it. Now, they did vertebroplasty in 90 patients, and then they did a sham intervention in 90 patients. All patients received a subcutaneous lidocaine injection and bupivacaine injection. And with a sham intervention, they did an excellent simulated surgery with the verbal and physical cues. They did the whole thing. They put them in the room, the lights, the cold, the metal, they did the whole thing. And what do you know? The baseline score of pain, remember, pain is the primary outcome here. Baseline score of pain, 7.7 and 7.9. After 1 month, there was no difference in pain scores. And after 12 months, there was, again, no difference in pain scores. Like, almost no difference at all. Right about 3. It didn't matter. Overall, vertebroplasty did not result in statistically significant greater pain relief than sham surgery, which makes us all ask the important question, should we be doing this? Should we be doing this at all? Now, I'm always super fascinated by studies that use old torture techniques to cure medical diseases, such as this one in Lancet, primary care led weight management for remission of type 2 diabetes, the DIRECT trial. What this study did was basically recruited a bunch of patients with type 2 diabetes. And they said, you've had type 2 diabetes and you've been diagnosed in the last 6 years. You have a body mass index, or a BMI, of 27 to 45, and you're not on insulin. So we want to put you in this trial. This trial is limiting you to 850 or 825 calories a day for the next 3 to 5 months. And then they would slowly reintroduce food and give you a supported structure to maintain long-term weight loss. The primary outcomes were weight loss of 15 kilograms, which is significant, over 30 pounds or more, and the remission of diabetes, defined by an A1C. Now, there was a control group that just had the control of, hey, you should try to lose weight, but they weren't held to the diet formula of 800 calories is the key here. Now, if you were in the intervention group, the odds at 12 months that you had a weight loss of 15 kilograms or more was 24% versus zero participants, so 0% of the control group, and the odds that you had diabetes remission was 46, almost 50% of the participants in the intervention group versus only 4% of the participants in the control group. And I think we all can say that it's expected. You held these people to a diet that's 820 calories, let's say. They then lost weight. They then lost their diabetes. I think the argument would come in for some people is that, yeah, but you're only giving them 800 calories. You're torturing them. They're not eating enough. They're not going to be happy with their life. They're going to be sad when they're sitting there watching their friends eat meals. Except they did a quality of life study in this as well, which is a visual analog. And wouldn't you know it, those individuals that were in the intervention group, those individuals that were only confined to 800 calories a day, were actually significantly happier than those in the control group. I think in the end, this points that in primary care, or really in any setting, holding your patient to 800 calories a day is probably not only beneficial for their health, it's definitely beneficial for their weight, but likely beneficial for their happiness. And now, you may not have special formula or diets that you can mail your patients so that way that they're on these diet replacement plans, but basically, you can just tell them, count your calories, put it in a logbook, bring it in to me every week. I mean, there are other ways to get around this, and it looks like this is the best way, at least the best way that I can find, because it beats any drug that we have out there to get rid of diabetes. And last but not least, maybe my favorite article of the whole bunch, so I'm going to try to wrap it up into a nice little juicy pearl, something to leave you questioning medicine as you travel into the weekend. This is a paper in JAMA, May 15th, Association of Colonoscopy Adenoma Findings with Long-Term Colorectal Cancer Incidence, JAMA 2018. And the goal here, or the objective of the study, was to compare long-term colorectal cancer incidence, so how often the person or how often we're finding colorectal cancer, by colonoscopy adenoma findings. Meaning, if we find an adenoma, how likely then are you to develop cancer? All right. This was a multi-center prospective cohort study of participants in the prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer randomized clinical trial of FlexSigs beginning back in 1993. The enrolled patients were randomized to a FlexSig or usual care. Then the participants who underwent FlexSig and had an abnormal finding were referred for follow-up. Subsequent colonoscopy findings were categorized as advanced adenoma greater than 1 centimeter with high-grade dysplasia or villous histology, or non-advanced adenoma less than 1 centimeter without advanced histology, or no adenoma at all. The primary outcome was colorectal cancer incident within 15 years of baseline colonoscopy, and the secondary outcome was colorectal cancer mortality. Now, on the initial colonoscopy, 18% of the patients had advanced adenoma, 31% had non-advanced adenoma, and 50% had no adenoma at all. The median follow-up for colorectal cancer incidence was 13 years. So, we basically have 18% of the patients with advanced adenoma, and then they follow them basically for 13 years saying, what's the incidence that this quote-unquote advanced adenoma develops into colorectal cancer? The colorectal cancer incidence per 10,000 person years was 20 for advanced adenoma, 9 for non-advanced adenoma, and 7.5 for if you had no adenoma at all. Now, people are saying, this is really good. I mean, look at this. 20 per 10,000 person years compared if you had an advanced adenoma compared to only 7.5 if you had no adenoma, which means this is what we're saying. These advanced adenomas, these quote-unquote high-risk polyps, make you 3 times more likely to develop colorectal cancer in the next 13 years. See, we knew it. Colonoscopies are the bomb diggity. There's our proof right there. However, let's go back to this a little bit. There was no significant difference in colorectal cancer risk between patients or participants with non-advanced adenoma compared with no adenoma at all. Meaning if I just went in and I found a little polyp that was not serious, you were not at an increased risk in the next 13 years to develop colorectal cancer. Not at all. So really, you are only at more risk for colorectal cancer or colorectal cancer death if you had a high-risk polyp. And again, some people are saying, there it is, there's our proof. That's what we've been waiting for this whole time, this proof that colonoscopies are a good thing because they find these high-risk polyps, these polyps that make you 3 times more likely to develop colorectal cancer in the next 13 years, and that's why we do what we do, but just wait 1 minute. If you go to a colonoscopy and you have a high-risk polyp, they tell you to come back. Usually come back in, you know, 1, 2, 3 years to repeat. It doesn't mean that you have colon cancer then the next time. They just say, listen, you're high risk. We need to retest you for cancer in 1 to 3 years. Now, the FIT test, the little card that you put your stool on and you send off, has a 95% accuracy for detecting colorectal cancer. 95%. And that's based on the gold line or the gold criteria, which is colonoscopy. However, we know from studies that colonoscopy does miss about somewhere in the realm of 3 to 5%. So the FIT test, which is 95% accurate, is really as good as it gets because it measures at about the same rate as colorectal cancer screening or colonoscopy for colorectal cancer. So if you do a FIT test and let's say it comes back negative, I could say, you are still at risk for colon cancer. We should rescreen you. And based on the American Cancer Society guidelines, we should rescreen you in 1 year. But you come back in 1 year, and again, this test of stool on a card has the same accuracy as a colonoscopy for detecting the things we care about. And let's say it's negative then. You can say, hey, it's negative, but you should come back in 1 year and get tested to get the same test that has the same accuracy as a colonoscopy. I think that this is great. This study shows that colonoscopies are good for giving us high-yield polyps that then will turn into colon cancer, or at least that's the connection we're making. However, the overwhelming majority are either no adenomas or low-risk adenomas. And remember, no-risk adenomas and low-risk adenomas are the same in the terms of colorectal cancer. So if they're the same, why are we even looking for them? We should only be looking for the high-yield ones. The high-yield ones require you to come back for another colonoscopy in 1 year, and so does a FIT test. And so, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this is my plea to you to say, no more screening colonoscopies. There's no more need to do bowel prep that's unnecessary. There's no more need to have your patients pay $1,000 for the anesthesia bill so they can get their colonoscopy. Because if you have to come back in 1 year, you might as well come back for a FIT test, not for another colonoscopy. It's FIT test, F-I-T. And with that, I'm going to end this podcast like I've ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.